Morning again, everybody. Thanks for coming. It's always a great pleasure to join you here at the Sacramento Buddhist Meditation Group, and it's nice that you are okay with online talks because it's a long drive for me from here to get there from your beach. I have a great admiration for your sangha. And I'm appreciative of your inviting me, and thanks to Helen for hosting today and taking care of me through the communications, so I knew what to do. So before I get into my Dharma talk, I want to say how sorry I am to hear about the passing of Barbara Reese, because Barbara was always the person who I communicated with when I visited Sacramento for years. I don't know how long. And she was such a wonderful person. She was so sweet and wise and understanding. It was so easy to visit with her being the liaison. And I always, in a way, looked forward to communicating with her and going back and forth with her with every visit. And so I was really sorry to hear that she had passed, but I was not surprised at all to hear that she did so with a lot of grace and compassion. So I really miss Barbara, and I'm sorry that she's not here with us this morning. And so I dedicate my talk this morning to her memory. May it be a blessing for this Sangha forever. So Helen told me that you've been working lately on the theme of here and now. And so I thought, well, I'll think about that for my Dharma talk today. So my Dharma talk this morning is about here and now. So, as you know, I practice Zen. Maybe some of you do too. And that's a Japanese form of Chan, the kind of Buddhism that was invented in China. And some people think that Chan is a sort of a hybrid of Taoism and Buddhism. And I remember in the early days when we were practicing Zen, people said, well, it's not Buddhism. But I think it is actually a form of Mahayana Buddhism. And Mahayana Buddhism is a very devoted, pietistic form of Buddhism. It has very colorful, imaginative sutras. It has a cosmic point of view, very different from the early Buddhism that's reflected in the Theravada tradition. And I'm thinking about Mahayana Buddhism right now because in our Dharma seminar, we've been studying one of the greatest of all Mahayana text called the Avatamsaka Sutra. We've been studying the 39th chapter of that sutra, the Gandavyuha, or the entry into the realm of reality, which is itself about 400-page wild text full of hundreds of pages of fantastic stories and imagery with long lists of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and cosmic practices designed to save all beings and all world systems. So right now my head is full of all that material. And that's in all of that is part of Zen and stands behind Zen. And it's all embedded in Zen. And yet, Zen, in this expression and method of practice, as everyone knows, is very direct and stripped down form of Buddhism. More or less, Zen is sort of known for saying that the whole of the Buddha's teaching, all the sutras and all the practices, boil down to just one simple thing. To simply be completely here as and where you are. And that if you do that, all of the teachings are always there. All the Buddhas and all the worlds throughout space and time are actually here and now, in every moment and in every place, which is exactly what the Gandavyuha and the Avatamsaka Sutra says. So the Mahayana Sutras focus on the Buddhas throughout space and time part of the equation, and Zen focuses on the here and now part of the equation. And in a very early text, the Buddha says something like, this mind, as it is luminous. Only it is covered up by defilements from without. So this means that from early on in Buddhist teaching, it was really understood that the fundamental nature of our mind is pure and perfect, but that fundamental nature is buried under a mountain of stupidity and confusion, so we don't know it's there. That stupidity and confusion is really not our fault exactly. We have come by it honestly due to causes and conditions from the past that we ourselves maybe didn't make. But there's no reason that we have to work through all that, because the pure Buddha mind is always there, shining right in the middle of it. And once we have deep trust in that mind, we can be all right with all the confusion. Being in touch with our fundamental mind, our confusion can simply fall away. That's what the Zen teachings say, and I think they don't think that they made this up. The Zen teachings feel like this has always been the teaching of the Buddha. But even more astonishingly and even more deeply, the more you look into it, the more you see that the conditioning and the confusion itself is also the pure Buddha mind. In other words, in the here and now, whatever arises, whether it's enlightenment or delusion, is awakening. And that's why the great way of the Buddha is actually radically simple and easy. All you have to do is fully enter this moment, here and now, and that's the Buddha mind. And you don't need a special moment to do that. It's always here, always available in any moment of time. Another thing, because I'm giving multiple classes, and another one, my wife Kathy and I are doing a class for the San Francisco Zen Center online, and we're studying one of the earliest Chan texts about the here and now, so happens. That text is called the Xin Shin Ming, and it was written by the third Zen ancestor, Chan, I should say, more correctly, the third Chan ancestor, Seng Tsan. So Chinese, especially ancient Chinese, is very hard to translate because it's so suggestive. It admits of many possible translations. But a good translation of the title, Xin Shin Ming, is Inscription on Faith in the True Mind. The poem is written in an ancient aphoristic rhyming form of four lines, I think of four characters each, and that form is called a Ming, hence Xin Shin Ming. And a Ming is an inscription. It's meant to literally be inscribed on stone or on a monument. So that's what Ming means in the title, Xin Shin Ming. And the two characters, Xin and Xin, which sound the same, but are actually different characters, they mean respectively trust or faith and mind. So here the word mind doesn't mean mental or thinking. It means the true mind, the Buddha mind, the pure, fundamental, awakened mind that is the essence of our ordinary mind, although we don't usually know that or experience that, but it's there all the time. And this, you could say, that's the reason why there needs to be spiritual practice, so that we can see past our confused and unhappy mind to our perfectly awakened mind, which is always there, but hard to see, and that's the process of practice. So this is a poem, I think, with 104, I think it has 146 four-line stanzas. And this poem describes the fundamental mind so that we can contemplate what the fundamental mind is and have faith in it. So the inscription on faith in true mind. And faith in true mind really means faith in ourselves, faith in what we really are. The opening stanza, the opening four-line stanza of the poem is really famous. It's so famous that there are three Zen koans in the Bucliffe Record collection. Three different koans that involve just that one stanza of the poem, the opening stanza. And in the koans, and the usual translation outside the koans too of that stanza, goes something like, "The true way is without difficulty, just avoid picking and choosing." Maybe you've heard that saying. It's actually pretty famous. "The true way is without difficulty, just avoid picking and choosing," or "the true mind is without difficulty, just avoid picking and choosing." But this is a little tricky because, of course, when you first hear it, okay, it makes sense, but then you think about it for a minute and you realize that the mind is all the time picking and choosing, discriminating, all the time. All perception, all thought, all feeling exists because of discrimination. So how could the true way be without difficulty when it's totally impossible? So that's what the stanza is sort of saying. And I think that's really right. The true way is easy and impossible. But I've been thinking about the Chinese characters in that line more closely, and I've come up with a different translation. Because the first character of the stanza, which is often called the true way or the great way or something, the first stanza, the first character, I mean, actually means arrival. So the phrase that we generally translate as the great way or the true way is actually literally the arrival way, which I guess, you know, to put that into sensible English, would be the complete way. Because when you arrive, you know, you've arrived, meaning now it's complete. You got there. So that means that the way or the mind is by its nature complete. Here and now is always complete. We might not think so. We might think, no, something is missing, something is lacking, something is not right. But the true mind is always complete, here and now. Nothing is ever lacking. So that's the first word, arrival, or complete. The word translated as way is the character Dao, which was already a really important religious term in China before Buddhism came to China. It was a word in Taoism, the same word, Dao, Taoism. And it does mean literally the way, but in Taoism it has the flavor of the truth, not just any ordinary way, but the true way, the truth, the mind itself. And so it's kind of interesting that the Chinese word for truth or ultimate truth is a word that means a path, a way. And that's why they use the word Dao to translate the Buddhist word Dharma. So maybe, especially in Chinese, but I think it was already true in Buddhism's anti-metaphysical teaching, that the truth, you know, the ultimate absolute truth is not a destination, not a something, not a holdable, cognizable object. But it's a way, it's a path, it's a process, it's something that has to move all the time, that cannot be fixed. So the complete truth is a way. The complete truth is always in motion. And that's true of here and now, isn't it? Here and now is not a fixed thing, because as soon as you try to fix it, it's gone, right? The here and now is slips through your fingers, becomes a new, different here and now as soon as you notice it. So the here and now is also strange. It's not exactly an experience. It's a way, it's a movement, it's an evanescence. But it's funny, isn't it, that the Tao, the truth, the here and now, forever in motion, is complete at the same time. So that which never arrives is by its nature complete, already has arrived. So this is already, those two characters that are easily translated as true way already include a lot of complexity and paradox right there in the first phrase of the Xinxin Ming. But it's more than that. I don't read Chinese, but I'm pretty sure that it's true that in Chinese there are no pronouns. Pronouns are understood through context. So that the idea of the picking and choosing in the line referring to us, you don't pick and choose, isn't really necessarily the way to read that line. The picking and choosing could refer to the way itself, not to us. The way itself doesn't pick and choose, doesn't discriminate the way we do. And the character in the line that is translated as avoid, to eschew or even dislike, dislikes picking and choosing, could refer to the way. So taking all this into account, maybe it's a little too complicated, but taking all that into account, I would translate the line like this, the opening line, this all-important line that carries the essence of the poem, of the teaching. I would translate like this: the complete way is easy, only it sloughs off all discrimination. So the here and now, the way the here and now really is, in other words, just ordinary reality, like this here and now we're living in this moment, the here and now actually does slough off all discrimination. In other words, every moment is simply what it is. And it is, in a way, complete, but also ongoing. So that paradox in thought is actually not a paradox in living. Every moment is complete, you know, it's totally what it is. And then it instantly gives way to something else. So every moment is complete and ongoing. Now, you and I might have all kinds of preferences, all kinds of judgments, but the great way, reality itself, includes all that. All of our likes and dislikes are included, if they are there, in the here and now. They're included, but the here and now is always beyond them. So in this case, what this is telling us then is not a matter of we're supposed to stop discriminating, which is really impossible. No, I think it's rather a matter of our appreciating that there is also in us something beyond that discrimination. And I'm sure you have noticed this. You've noticed, I'm sure, that what happens actually does happen. You can't make it unhappen. You might not like it, but if it happens, it actually happens. You can't say, let's have that last moment unhappen. No. What happens absolutely happens, whether you like it or not. So no matter what our state of mind or situation, awakening, the poem is telling us, is always here in this moment we are living right now. And this moment we are living right now is radically beyond our preferences. We have a lot of preferences. And we have a lot of anguish and a lot of unhappiness because of our preferences. And we think we should make the world be organized around our preferences, which is really hard to do, very frustrating. And in the end, it really is impossible to do, because really the number one preference that we have is that we would live and not die. And we cannot realize that preference. And we hope that the people that we love, we prefer that they would live and not die, and yet we can't make that happen either. And when you really come down to it, the same is true of all of our other preferences. Yes, we might be able to organize them to some extent. You know, we can go to the restaurant and order what we prefer, and the waiter will bring it. But in the big picture of things, in the end, things really don't work out the way we want them to. So then we might, on the other hand, say, okay, well, this is too hard. Let's do the opposite. Let's reduce our preferences or change them somehow, or maybe we can eliminate them. And then we can be very austere in our living. But this is a tall order and takes a lot of work, and it's very complicated. But the Shin Shin Ming says, no, it is actually not complicated. It is very easy, because the complete mind is always here and now, and it always easily sloughs off all discrimination. So there's nothing to do and nothing to worry about. So this first line of the poem is quite astonishing, because it's giving us a sense of the profound obviousness and simplicity of the way, which is not the way we feel about it, right? We think, oh my God, Buddhism is so complex, and there's so many teachings and so many things to know and so much meditation to do and so much to cut through. But here it's saying, no, actually it's the opposite. The way is radically uncomplicated. We may be complicated, and we may easily make Buddhism or our spiritual practice into something very complicated, but the truth of the matter is, it is radically easy. And here's the thing. As complicated as we may be, we are also, because we are living beings in a physical world, determined to obey the laws of the universe absolutely, like all living and non-living beings must do, because we are that, we are the complete way. We are uncomplicated. You know, living and dying, we all know how to do it, right? You don't need instructions in how to die. Everybody somehow knows how to do it, even though it seems like a really hard thing. Because we're living beings and we obey the laws of the universe. And so, therefore, we ourselves, complicated as we are at the same time radically uncomplicated. So the true way is easy. It just sloughs off picking and choosing. It sloughs off all discrimination, and so do we in the end. But later, about two-thirds of the way through the poem, it says, the great way is broad, neither easy nor difficult. So now it sort of contradicts itself. It's neither easy nor difficult. So this is telling us that, oh, wait a minute, easy and difficult are human concepts. They're ideas that we made up based on our preferences. We like easier, we don't like easy, whatever. We make easy up and difficult up. After all, to discriminate between easy and difficult is already discrimination, right? And the great way is beyond all of that. So, even though in the beginning the poem calls the way easy, actually you can't call it easy or difficult. And this reminds me of a wonderful passage, one of the most beautiful passages in all Zen literature, that actually is about these lines of the Shin Shin Ming that I'm referring to. And it's in the form of a dialogue, because all Zen literature is dialogues, you know, conversations between Zen people. In this case, the conversation is between three family members, Layman Pong and his wife, Mrs. Pong, and their daughter, Ling Zhao. The three of them were famous Zen practitioners, famous awakened Zen practitioners, living together as a family in Tang Dynasty China. And they would have known the Xinxin Ming, which was written some centuries before they lived. So, here's the story. The layman was sitting in his cottage one day, maybe doing Zazen, and all of a sudden he exclaimed, "Difficult, difficult. It's like trying to scatter 10 measures of sesame seed all over a tree." Mrs. Pong said, "Easy, easy. It's like touching your feet to the ground when you get out of bed. Neither difficult nor easy," Ling Zhao said. "On the 100 grass tips, the great master's meaning." So that's pretty much captures what all 146 stanzas of the poem are saying. The complete way is impossible. In other words, you can't know it, you can't master it, you don't figure it out. But it's also literally as easy as getting out of bed in the morning and putting your feet on the floor. And it is both easy and difficult because it is everywhere you look, everywhere you hear, everywhere you taste, touch, feel in your body, it's everywhere. And yet at the same time, you can never grasp it. So, bringing this down to practice, I guess the take-home message would be this. Point number one, relax. We're already there, so we don't have to stress out with our frustrating effort. There's nothing to get that we don't already have in the here and now. And second, yes, we have to keep on practicing because there's always more to understand and appreciate around us wherever we look. And our job as human beings is to appreciate that, and that takes the effort of practice. So relax. Don't worry, everything is already there, and keep making effort and appreciating this life. Another verse in the poem says, "The more you think and talk, the more you lose the way. Cut off all thinking and practice freely anywhere." So you hear this kind of language a lot in Zen teachings about how bad thinking and talking is. But just like as human beings, we can never stop discriminating. Also, we will never stop thinking and talking. And after all, it's a kind of a pleasure to think and talk. After I'm done with my talk here, you guys will hang out a little bit and you'll talk together and you'll make connection with each other through your talking. So thinking and talking, thinking about things is also kind of a pleasure, as is talking together. So thinking and talking is not evil, it's a special talent, in fact, that human beings have that other creatures don't have in the same way. And think of all the wonders that have been produced by our thinking and talking. So no, it's not like thinking and talking are bad. On the other hand, I think we all know that thinking and talking can be very problematic sometimes. So we have to look into this question of thinking and talking, and maybe it turns out there's more than one kind of thinking and talking. And that's certainly true. There's a lot of kinds of thinking and talking. And I think the Xinxin Ming is pointing out the kind of thinking and talking that maybe we could say is egoistic thinking and talking. Thinking and talking driven by the energy of which comes from our being stuck on ourselves, which certainly we are. Thinking and talking can make us very miserable when it's defensive and distorted and misguided and self-justifying or pushing away somebody else because who they are seems to have a bad reflection on who we are. So that kind of thinking and talking, yeah, we can agree, it is kind of makes you miserable. Now, you can't really cut off egoistic thinking and talking entirely, but you can engage it as a practice by noticing clearly how stupid it really is. I mean, when you get into that, it doesn't go anywhere. It just sort of gets obsessive, and it makes you miserable, and it ends up sapping all your creative energy. And you study that in yourself. And when you see that that's the case, then you won't encourage that kind of thinking. You can't cut it off, although I'm sure, pretty sure, that the Chinese probably says exactly cut it off, because that's how Chan people talk. But I'm sure that even then, in those days, in actual practice, you need to just be patient with your egoistic thinking. And if you're patient with it and just see it for what it is, you won't encourage it, and then it'll go away by itself. So though you can't cut off egoistic thinking, you can eventually be done with it, because it can wear itself out and not come around again, or at least not come around again too often, because you haven't been adding fuel to the fire. You can't will it away, in other words, because willing it away, that effort, only makes it stronger, but you can let it fall away by itself. And I think that everybody who practices meditation for a while kind of gets that point through trial and error. You realize, yeah, that's right. I can't stop my mind from doing what it does, but I don't have to encourage the more stupid manifestations of my mind, and they will pretty much fall away after a while if I keep breathing and sitting here. These lines about thinking and talking, though, could refer to another kind of thinking and talking also, which is maybe we could call philosophical thinking and talking, our human tendency to try to understand things and figure them out. Now, you know, it might be interesting to figure things out. I mean, a lot of people have that's their job, right, to try to figure things out. And maybe that can be useful to some extent. But in the end, the most important things can't be figured out. And our thinking about them is a waste of time, especially if it distracts us from the complete mind here and now. I used to study philosophy, and every time I read a philosopher, I was completely sure that that philosopher was right about things, because they were always very smart and very convincing. And so I would say, that's it. But then I would study the next philosopher, who would say something completely different, but equally convincing, and I would think, that's it. So this was a little confusing. And the same can be true of Dharma teachings. Zen is famous for the slogan, beyond words and letters, pointing directly to the complete mind. Or we could say, in terms of how we're framing this today, pointing directly to the here and now. So, we do give Dharma talks. Here I am, giving one right now. But we don't expect anybody to remember them or think about them much, because we're giving the Dharma talk not to philosophize or give you pointers or somehow define reality, but to encourage you to enter the true mind yourself, to enter here and now without confusion. So it's not that it's prohibited to think about the teachings to some extent, but remember not to think about them too much, because figuring out the teachings is not the point. The point is to be present and enter fully the complete mind here and now. So philosophy as a pursuit is kind of interesting and worthwhile, I guess, but it does not solve the problem of being human in the end. Practicing Dharma is for that. Practicing Dharma is for the purpose of solving the problem of being human, and you can't really philosophize yourself into that. You have to get to it through effort over time, And yes, the effort might involve some thinking. It's not that that's forbidden. But it has to be more than thinking. It has to be also pervade your emotions, your perceptions, your body, your breath, your mind, your heart. Usually we come to the practice because our brains tell us to. They say, well, this might be a good thing to do. This makes sense. So we come. But we have to go beyond the brain and the thinking in order to actually fully do the practice. We have to make a big effort in practice simply because we are determined to do so. Not so that we can answer any theoretical questions or get something that we don't already have. Devotion and commitment, which is usually called vow, is at the heart of all Mahayana Buddhist practice, including Zen. In the Soto Zen that I practice, Dogen and Suzuki Roshi's style of Zen practice, we think of Zazen, which is what we call meditation, Zazen, as not being meditation, not a method, but simply sitting in the middle of the here and now. Sitting in the middle of the koan, of being alive in the present moment, which Dogen calls Genjo Koan. But I guess, of course, we do have some kind of a method, like I was instructing in the beginning. We sit up straight, breathe, pay attention to the breath, and so on. That's sort of our method in Soto Zen. Other schools of Zen have other methods. Of course, in Buddhism, there's many, many methods. And all of them are good, and all of them can be useful depending on the situation. But once you give yourself completely to your method of practice, all methods really become the same method or no method at all. Because all methods come down to just being here and now, just being alive in the complete mind, which sloughs off all discrimination, all problems, and having trust, faith in that mind. Suzuki Roshi once famously said to his young Zen students a long time ago, and this is one of the really famous moments of all the wonderful moments of Suzuki Roshi's talking about Dharma. He said, and I think he didn't, you know, think about this in advance. I think he just sort of looked out at all the people who were listening to him, and he said, I think he shook his head maybe, and he said, you know, the problems you have now, you will always have. And this, I think, kind of shocked people, because they came to practice exactly to get rid of their problems, to escape their problems and have them go away somehow. And so it was shocking when he said, the problems you have now, you will always have. But what Suzuki Roshi was saying, I think, was that the problems you have now may not be as you see them. They may not be as bad as you think they are. And they only seem bad because you don't really understand your problems. And that's why you're trying to escape them. And you're imagining some future blissful, problemless state. But when you understand your problems, as they really are, here and now, you allow the complete mind that is always present in you to slough off all discrimination, even in the middle of discrimination, and then your life is very easy, even if it seems to be hard. Because the problems you have are the problems you need. If they're here, they're here. And this must be true for every problem of every one of us, and it must also be true for the world in general. The problems we have are the problems we need. So thank you very much for listening to my Dharma talk, and I appreciate it very much, your kindness and receptivity. And now, I guess, we can have some time for questions, and I can respond. It doesn't have to be a question, you know. It can be a comment. I'm not here to answer questions particularly. Anything anybody wants to say, both online and in person, let's see what people want to say, and then I'll respond. If I have something to say, I'll respond. So thank you, and let's talk.
Thank you, Norman.